The Fire by Francesca, read by Dedificus. Part 1, Cascade, Washington, 2000. Come on, guys, he's just a kid. Blair was rocking enthusiastically on his heels in front of Simon's desk. He'd gone all save the children on us, which was going to make for a long afternoon. I groaned. Simon's voice was flat and final. He had a gun, Sandberg. Sandberg leaned forward and braced his palms on Simon's desk. He's 14. 14, Simon. Sandberg's voice sculpted the number into a whine. What is that, a freshman in high school? I slid down in my chair at the conference table. High school of the damned, maybe. What was he doing? Trying to get a letter in armed robbery? Simon sent me an appreciative glance, telling me we were on the same page. I was on the debate team myself, he said, and flashed me a barely there smile. Ha ha. Sandberg straightened up and rolled his eyes. You guys are hilarious. You kill me. Now can we get serious and cut this kid a break? Have you guys even seen him? He looks like Leonardo DiCaprio. Why can't we send old Leo to juvenile court where he belongs? Simon's eyes were suddenly steely. He braced his own huge palms on the desk in front of him and slowly rose from the chair. I suppressed a smile as Sandberg slowly craned his neck up and up and up. Let me ask you something, Sandberg. Simon's voice was quiet, forceful, deadly. How do you think this would have gone down if old Leo were black, huh? If Leo were a black kid instead of a white kid? What kind of conversation do you think we'd be having right now? Sandberg swallowed hard and nodded vaguely. But to my surprise, he stood his ground. The same one, I hope, Captain. Simon opened his mouth to argue, but Sandberg seized the initiative. Fucking ballsy, that kid. No, look, I hear you. Believe me, I hear you, okay? I know what you're gonna say. Black kid, he's an animal. He needs to be tried as an adult. Hell, black kid waving a gun around? We're lucky he's still alive at this point. I know that. Don't you think I know that? Simon's face was contorted with what looked like rage. Sandberg, pale and gesticulating wildly as he talked, looked like a man trying to placate an angry thunder god. I know what you're going to say. I know they've put these goddamn laws on the book, Simon. I know they want to try children as adults, but only black children. It's never their Jimmy or their precious Timmy or... Damn right it isn't, Simon ground out. Sweet little Leonardo DiCaprio, but Simon, Sandberg cried, reaching his crescendo. Dude, it's still wrong. I couldn't believe my ears. Dude? Simon didn't even bat an eyelash. Sandberg's passion was that persuasive. It's still wrong, Simon, Sandberg rushed off. Wrong either way. Come on, right? You gotta see that man, and you gotta know I'd be having this conversation with you if it was MC Leo D out there. And if I don't, the day I don't, you just kick my ass out of this department. And down the street and into the fucking bay, Simon, please. Okay, Jesus. And with a mighty groan, the Thunder God collapsed back into his chair. So, I imagine, did David slay Goliath. Simon shot me a haggard look that asked, how do you put up with this shit? And I just shrugged and looked away. All right, Sandberg, Simon said finally, sounding like a man with a headache of biblical proportions. Tell you what, you get the kid to spill it all? He recites, he explains, he confesses remorse, and I'll throw my weight behind the idea of juvenile court. Sandberg let out a long breath. Okay, fair enough. He glanced at me, then jerked his head toward the door. I sighed wearily and hauled myself out of my chair. Thanks, Simon. You won't regret this. Regrets, Simon said darkly. I've had a few. Sandberg didn't rise to the bait. He just bowed and scraped his way out of Simon's office. Only once the door was shut did he allow himself a jaunty little dance of victory in the middle of the bullpen. Oh man, that was close. That was so fucking close. But hey, we did it. School won for truth, justice, and the American way. I was in no mood. Putting kids in jail is truth, justice, and the American way. Sandberg just snorted and ignored me. And truth be told, that was one of the things I liked best about him. Sandberg just wouldn't believe the worst of me. Of course I'd been on his side. Of course I had been on the right side. The idea that I hadn't been wouldn't have even crossed his mind. Okay, so listen, Sandberg said, turning to rummage on his desk for little Leo's paperwork. I think, when you interrogate him... Wait, whoa, I said, raising my hands. Me? I'm not interrogating him. He's your charity case. You interrogate him. Sandberg looked up, apparently shocked. Me? Why would I interrogate him? You're the master of interrogation, man. Your pet project, man, I snapped. You want to do pro bono work? It's your case, your idea, your kid. I sat down at my own desk. Keep me out of it, all right? But... Sandberg fumbled for words, and then, of course, being Sandberg, he found them. Jim, look, you're better at this than me, okay? You just are, and you know it. We need a full confession from this kid, or they're going to send him to hell. And our best chance of that is for you to go in there and shake him up a bit. Make him realize what's at stake. And then, when he does... Your case, your kid, your interrogation, I repeated firmly, opening a file on my desk. Jim, man. And now there was an edge to Sandberg's voice. I really could use your help here, okay? I kept my eyes fixed on the report in front of me. I don't interrogate kids, Sandberg. Leonardo's your problem. I felt the heat of Sandberg's stare. It made me feel like shit. I was letting him down. I was disappointing him. I was forcing him to think the worst of me. Like he could ever know the worst of me. The kid hadn't a fucking clue. Fine, Sandberg said finally. Fine, I'll take care of it. And when I finally dared to look up from my desk, he was well and truly gone. I tried to drown myself in work. I tried not to notice Sandberg's absence. But Sandberg left a big void for a small guy. The world was a lot quieter and less colourful when he wasn't around. I glanced at my watch every so often, hating myself every time I did it. 20 minutes, half an hour, 45, and still Sandberg didn't come back from the interrogation rooms. Of course, he would eventually. He'd give the kid to Spill and he'd come back, having done another good deed, hooray, bully for him. No doubt it would turn out that the kid was only robbing convenience stores at gunpoint because his sister needed a kidney transplant and his mother was on crack. The kid would cry, Sandberg would cry, the lawyers would cry. Then they'd all have a fucking group hug and be done with it. 1 hour and 10 minutes. I groaned, relented, and went down 2 floors to see what the fuck was going on. Sandberg's voice came to me first, clear as a bell, even though he was whispering. Just lose her, can't you? Snarl her up in paperwork. That kid gets a lawyer now, and we're all fucked, him more than anyone. Blair, I'm trying, okay? I knew that voice. That was Sandberg's pal, Catherine Bowe. Sandberg and Bowe got on famously. Had bonded instantly as station outsiders. 2 Venusians on Mars. Take us to your fucking leader. But she's getting pretty damn impatient. We've kept her out for 40 minutes already. Just keep her out. I need more time. Have her fill out another form or something. Check her ID again. The kid's parents are here too, Blair. There's money behind this kid. That woman's wearing a Tahari suit and she wants to see her client. Please, Kat. My stomach churned. Sandberg was begging, and I couldn't stand to hear it. Please, send her to the wrong room. Make a mistake, anything. Just lose her. Bo blew out a long sigh. I'll get you as much time as I can, okay? Okay, okay. I heard Bo's footsteps disappear down the hall. I rounded the corner. The hallway was now empty, but my ears told me that Sandberg and the kid were in room 2. I went to the door and knocked briskly. A few seconds later, the door opened, and I was staring into Sandberg's exhausted face. Oh, it's you. Sandberg stepped out into the hallway with me, pulling the door shut behind him. What do you want? He asked, and glanced at his watch pointedly. I haven't got a whole lot of time here, okay? Give me a crack at him, I said. It came out sounding rough, like I was angry. I wasn't, though. It was just that my throat was tightening up. Sandberg kept his face hard for a moment or two, and then melted, actually melted in front of my eyes. Here comes Jim to save the day, but of course, he knew it was a misunderstanding all along. Geez, thanks, man, Sandberg said, and I hated him right then, hated him for the relief in his voice. So look, here's the story. I have tried to explain the situation to this kid, that he was possessing a gun, that that's a felony, that he's going to get tried as an adult, but I don't think he believes me. He looks at me and thinks summer camp. I can see it in his eyes, Jim. He looks at me and thinks of the guy who arranged badminton games at camp I'm a fucking rich kid. He's got parents and a high-priced lawyer waiting, and if they convince him to shut up, to deny everything and tough it out, he's going to become a fucking test case, Jim. The whole weight of the fucking system is going to come crashing down on his head to prove that the new law isn't racist, which of course it fucking is. I put a hand on his shoulder and squeezed it, trying to stop the flow of words. I got it. I need you to scare the shit out of him, Sandberg said flatly. I need you to get him to see that this ain't going to be summer camp. I got it, I repeated. Go get a cup of coffee. Come back in 10 minutes. Sandberg raised an eyebrow at me. 10 minutes? 10 minutes, Sandberg, I said, and nudged him down toward the 5th floor break room. 10 minutes will be plenty of time. I could scare the shit out of this kid by just showing him what I really was. Sandberg was right. The kid looked exactly like Leonardo DiCaprio. Sort of a mean, sullen DiCaprio. Or did that go without saying? He looked up when I entered, his pretty mouth set in an adult snarl. Ooh, tough guy. I leaned back against the door and crossed my arms, wanting to show him that I wasn't impressed. Except I sort of was impressed. By his youth. 14, Sandberg had said. Certainly he was the youngest perp I'd ever attempted to interrogate. I already got queasy when I was 17 or 18. Far too young for all that testosterone, for all that fucking attitude. But this was the real deal. This was my nightmare. Dirty blonde hair falling into smoke grey eyes, and not even peach fuzz on his smooth, soft cheeks. Pre-peach fuzz. Good God. The kid shifted in his chair and squared his narrow, boyish shoulders defiantly, glaring up at me. I could snap him like a twig if I wanted to, but somehow that only made things worse. I held steady by the door and stared at him, waiting patiently, letting the silence and tension grow between us. Time. I had plenty of time. I had all the time in the world, all the power, all the control. He'd have to impress me. The first word spoken would be his. I watched as his defiance began to wilt under the weight of my focused attention, though he struggled manfully to maintain it. But finally, he cracked. They all do. "Who are you, my bodyguard?" I narrowed my eyes at him, trying to look menacing, hoping he wouldn't see how much he'd freak me out. Not with his words, but with his voice. A high-pitched voice on the brink of changing. "God bless Sandberg. God bless Sandberg and his dials." I wrenched everything down to absolute zero. Hear no evil, see no evil, think no evil. I was going in. Slowly I detached myself from the wall, grabbed a chair, turned it around, and sank down into it in one fluid motion. I leaned forward over the seat back and stared into his face. We were way, way too close now, but my dials were still holding firm at zero. Leo twitched nervously away from me, but tried to stop himself, to control his reaction. Ugh, brave, brave, stupid little boy. I reached out and grabbed his hairless chin between my thumb and forefinger. I pinched and pulled his smooth, pale face close to mine, close enough to feel his breath. His grey eyes went wide with horror. "Oh yes, my boy, my darling boy, you're getting it now. This is not summer camp. This is giving your life to me and men like me, men worse than me. This is your wake-up call, kid." "Listen," I said softly, "Detective Sandberg is trying to help you. He's trying to stop you from being tried as an adult. He's trying to stop you from getting sent to an adult jail where your sweet little ass will be split open like a dandelion stem. I have no idea why he gives a shit about your pathetic little life, but he does, and so I'm going to help him, and he's going to help you. So you just listen up now. You may be the toughest kid in ninth grade, but you are a nothing." I stopped then, watching him closely for a reaction. Leo was hyperventilating now, panting in, out, in, out, in, out, hot, sweet breath in my face. I closed my own eyes and inhaled deeply, surprised and grateful that I felt nothing myself, not even a hint of desire. Maybe all those years of restraint had changed me. Maybe I didn't have to be so afraid anymore. I opened my eyes again, and Leo's lips were trembling now. Round lips, girl pink and softly curved, but not nearly as sweet as those forbidden lips in the very darkest closet of my memory. Not nearly as round and full as those other lips that had ruined my life, that had made me confront the monster I really was. "Go ahead, kid," I thought. "Cry now. Cry now and then confess it all. Save your life." "What do I have to do?" Leo asked finally, really looking on the verge of tears. I smiled approvingly, and his smoky eyes grew wet with unshed tears. "Good boy. Good, good boy. He was going to confess. Sandberg would be happy. This would all be over soon." Curious, I let my dials ease up a bit. 1, 2, 3. And breathed in the barest hint of boy scent, sports stick, and the splash of grown-up aftershave. The musky stuff they marketed to kids in Details magazine. Boys with too much cash to spend on shoes and hair gels and designer shirts. And still, no desire, nothing. Could it be that something within me had grown, had changed, had evolved? After 19 years of resistance, 19 years of shoring up my defences, 19 years of keeping my distance from boys and turning myself, training myself on women, could I have possibly outgrown the urge? Dr. Arenberg had said it was possible, but surely. The first tear splashed its way down Leo's face. He let out an awkward boy snort and jerked his face out of my hand, lifting his arm and swiping his shirt roughly across his face. "Okay," Leo said. His face crumpled like an old school lunch bag. "Just Tell me what to do. Do whatever you want me to do. I give up, okay? Okay. I let my dial slide up. 4, 5, 6. And reached across to stroke his neck with my fingertips. He flinched, hunched his shoulders, let out a sobbing gasp. And while my senses enhanced the feel of his smooth skin and filled my mouth with the scent of him, still nothing. Absolutely nothing. No desire. Not a flicker. Not a single solitary spark. Dear God, thank you. God, thank you. I slapped Leo briskly on the shoulder and stood up. I'll get Detective Sandberg. He'll take your confession, make sure everything's all nice and legal-like. And if you're lucky, you'll end up at Hartford Juvenile, bullying boys smaller than yourself. I kicked my chair toward the table with my foot. It made a scraping metallic sound. If you're unlucky, you'll run into me at 17. So watch your back. I reached for the door, yanked it open, and strode into the hallway. Sandberg leaped up off the wall where he'd been hovering, waiting. Well? I couldn't look at him. He's all yours, I said, and strode off down the hall. Part 2. Kabul, Afghanistan, 1980. Anything else? Professor Gregor leaned back on his chair and stared up at him. Even the smallest thing could help us. Jim closed his eyes and thought hard. No. No, sir, I don't think so. He opened his eyes and then added, I did try to be thorough, sir. I tried to remember everything I could for my report. The Mohadin, I think they're beginning to trust me. Perhaps this month. It is possible, but of course I can't be certain yet. Gregor chewed the inside of his cheek and nodded slowly, then leaned forward and laced his fingers together on the desk. And what about you? Gregor murmured quietly, showing that he was aware of violating the rules by asking the question. Are you all right? You're a little young for this kind of work, no? I'm fine, sir, Jim replied, and that was a hell of an understatement. He loved this assignment. He loved his new identity, loved his East German passport, loved his tiny student rooms near the Polytechnic, loved his blonde hair and the little steel glasses with the clear glass lenses. He loved the musical lilt he'd used to inflect his English, and sometimes, when he looked at himself in his small shaving mirror, he didn't recognize himself. He loved that best of all. In Kabul, it sometimes seemed to him that there was no such place as Cascade, Washington. No such person as William Ellison. No Stephen, no Sally, no Jim. Here, he carried a passport that declared him to be Christoph Schmidt, a graduate student in mathematics, working with an international team of Russian, German, Polish, and Romanian students under the supervision of Professors Gregor, Gruber, Dostum, and Trevenev. Half the students were CIA plants, like himself. Gregor and Trevenev were long-time moles. The rest of the students were clueless, and did proportionally more of the math, though he himself certainly knew enough to talk the talk, and found that he was actually fairly good at fractal geometry. In any case, Jim added with a frown, I believe that my age was a factor in this assignment. Gregor shrugged. Still, you're quite the youngest student we have in this department. Gregor's lilt was a genuine article, and Jim listened closely, studying it. Youngest student we have. I just want to make sure you're doing all right. I'm fine, sir, Jim repeated. Really? All right, I'll put that in the record. Gregor waved his hand at the door, telling Jim that he was dismissed. I'll make sure that this reaches the right parties. Jim nodded, stood up. Thank you, sir, he said, and opened the door. Once outside, he glanced at his watch. There was no point in going back to the common rooms, and it was too early for the dark bars, where students whispered in dark corners about the holy war. His stomach rumbled, and he decided to get food. He could go down to the marketplace, get takeaway from a stand, kebabs and samosa, and maybe a mango, if he was lucky and there was fruit today. He passed out through the door of the modern polytechnic and began to wander through the ancient, narrow, crowded streets. It was twilight and vaguely rush hour. There was a lot of foot and animal traffic, and from the sidelines, merchants peddled their wares in sing-song Dari chants. Food! Fresh hot food here! Cheap! Rice by the pound! Take it home! Good rice! Feed your whole family for mere pulls! Nuts! Cheap! Buy the bag! Sweet good nut meat! Jim stifled a grin, tried to ignore his general feeling of well-being. It wasn't safe to be so happy in a situation like this. You were bound to fuck up, make a crucial mistake. Still, though, it was dry and warm for evening, and he stepped out of the street traffic and pressed himself against the side of an old stone wall. The low stone and wood buildings of the city seemed ancient, something out of the Arabian Nights. The far-off domes of the mosques seemed older still, and the huge, overhanging mountains of the Hindu Kush, flushed pink and gold in the fractured half-light of evening, were of another world altogether. Fantastic. Wonderful. It was a place to get lost in, a place where one could disappear completely. Jim adjusted his glasses and let himself be swept away by the traffic of the street. A few blocks down, he bought a kebab and some paratha from Sigabatullah, one of the few merchants whose food he trusted. Munching on the hot, spiced lamb, he turned down one of the quieter side streets that led to his rooms. Strange. The mountains and the sky really did look uncommonly pink tonight. On the next street, he passed a woman he recognized, Saleya, leading an overladen camel down the unpaved street. He bowed to her in the stiff, dramatic way he'd mastered during his training period. So different from the easygoing American body language of just a few years ago. From Jimmy Ellison, captain of the Cascade Wildcats, and passed by her, not speaking to her. Her husband would beat her nearly to death if she was seen exchanging words with a man, even a foreigner. Pink, he thought again, squinting up at the sky. Pink, gold, flickering gold. And then, all at once, the burning smell reached his nose, and there were people running toward him, running away from the fire, because of course it was a fire, somewhere ahead, in the next block or two. Jim dropped the remainder of his kebab into the street and started running, pushing through the fleeing crowds, running toward while everyone else was running away. Or almost everyone. A small crowd had gathered at the end of the street, at the sight of the fire. Dear God, it had spread. It was licking at nearly an entire block of attached buildings now. One single long stone facade, with flames dancing in the second-story windows. But the insides, Jim thought with a sinking feeling, the insides would be nearly all wood. The outside shell would remain, but the insides would be fragile, inflammable. He stopped at the outskirts of the crowd and watched as two men wrangled a series of neighing, rearing horses out through a first-floor entryway from the stables beyond the facade.
Entschuldigung, Jim said to no one in particular. Ist Schädel entangen? Ist das Haus leer?
Empty, he added hastily, feeling that the baffled looks he was getting allowed him to switch into English. Has everyone gone?
Yes, a young man answered him finally in broken English. No one home now.
Jim nodded, relieved, and turned his attention back to the blaze, still spreading downwind, engulfing more houses, and he could hear a voice, carried to him on the wind, a high-pitched scream,
blending in with the shriek of the fire. He wheeled, grabbed the young man's shoulders and said, "Are you sure nobody's in there? Are you sure the house is empty?" The young man stared at him, shocked. The crowd stared at him and backed away from the foreigner, the white, blonde foreigner who was attacking the local boy. "Yes," the young man cried. "Yes, empty. House empty." But Jim could still hear a voice, unless he was going crazy, unless it was just the fire screaming. "I hear a voice," he said in English, and then in German, and then in Persian. "I hear a voice. There's someone in there. I hear a voice." They were all backing away from him now, and he wheeled on them, appealing mutely. "Help! Somebody help me, please." English, Jim realized dimly. The voice was speaking English too. Before he'd consciously decided what he was going to do, he was diving through the crowd, pushing through them toward the fire-engulfed houses. They parted and let him pass. They wouldn't stop him. They wouldn't interfere with a white foreigner, even a crazy one. Instinctively, he headed for the second doorway from the end, not knowing why, just going by gut feeling and the direction of his senses. He passed through the stone arch into a smoke-filled room, ripping off his jacket as he went. It was hot, so hot in here. He paused, listened, heard the voice again, louder, stronger, sobbing. "Help! Please, help!" And without thinking, he barreled toward it, running up the winding wooden stairs. The landing at the top was even thicker with smoke. There were three closed wooden doors running along the corridor, and he yelled out, "Where are you? I can't hear you." His words were instantly met with a faint pounding sound and a hoarse yell. "I'm here. Hey, right here, please." He moved quickly up the hallway, not the first door, but yes, the second. He reached for the knob and yanked his hand back quickly, stung by the burning heat of the iron knob. "Are you in there?" Jim yelled, feeling the wood door with his fingertips. It too was hot. "Yes, I'm locked in." "Get away from the door, you hear me? Get away from the door and stay down. Down the ground." "Okay," the voice said, and it sounded further away now, so he took his chance and threw himself hard at the door. Nothing at first, just a pain in his shoulder. He lurched back and tried again, and this time the wood splintered. Once more, and the boards bent inwards. The door flew open, and he lurched wildly into the smoke-filled room. A small boy was cowering on the ground, his face covered in what looked like a wet piece of cloth. Good boy. Smart boy. Jim ran forward and grabbed him by the arm. Grateful blue eyes, framed by dark lashes, tearing with the acrid smoke, met his own. "Come on," Jim yelled, and tugged the boy off the floor. "We've got to get out of here." He pulled the boy back through the fractured door. And hell, the flames had now reached the second floor, were licking up the wooden staircase, devouring everything in its path. He could feel the boy cringing away from the heat, from the fire. But the only way through, the only way out, was forward. He dragged the boy forward towards the staircase, and then suddenly, abruptly, realized that they weren't going to make it. The route was blocked. Shielding the boy from the flames with his body, Jim quickly made note of his options, which quickly came down to death or the back window. Pulling the boy with him, he leaned out through the stone opening. There was a one-story shack a few feet away. They could probably... Jim yanked the boy up, off the floor and into his arms. "Hang on, okay?" he yelled over the roar of the flames. "Just hang on tight." The boy didn't say anything. but his arm snaked tightly around Jim's neck and his legs wound around Jim's waist. Jim steadied himself with his hands against the stone wall, then stepped onto the windowsill. There was no ledge, and the clinging boy was now dangling 20 feet above the ground. Worse yet, the shack's roof was obscured by the rising clouds of grey smoke. But even as he concentrated, it grew clearer, like his eyes were filling in the picture with details from his memory. In any case, it had to be there, so he made what wasn't quite a leap of faith and jumped. He first felt the jolt as he fell hard onto the rooftop, and then seconds later, the searing heat on his hands, on his knees. The roof was made of metal, and below him, underneath him, the boy was screaming. Instantly, he rolled, pulling the boy off the roof and onto his chest, feeling the agonizing heat on his back, his buttocks. Taking a deep breath, he pushed upwards, found his feet, and, still carrying the boy, quickly moved to the edge of the roof and jumped down to the ground. They landed in soft dirt and rolled twice before stopping, Jim being careful that the boy should come up on top. The boy let go of him and scrambled into a sitting position just as Jim sat up. Jim frowned. The boy was breathing hard, nearly choking, his small round face smeared with dirt. "You okay?" Jim asked him, and the boy nodded vigorously. "I'm fine. I'm cool. Just..." The boy sort of waved his hand around, and Jim nodded grimly, knowing exactly what he meant. They were now behind the building, in a single large communal area that was squared in on all sides. Around them, the building burned, flames shooting high into the air, orange and yellow against the darkening sky. In the centre, the grounds had been partitioned into separate gardens. Some of the owners had built freestanding stables. Others had built chicken sheds or gardening huts. Some were growing herbs or fruit or nuts or opium. It was hard to tell now, because the gardens too were starting to burn. The smaller animals, abandoned in favour of the larger ones, were shrieking and running amok. Chickens, sheep, a herd of panicked goats. "We got to get out of here," Jim said, rising to his feet. Beside him, the boy got up too. "We can't. There's no way out. The doors are all locked to keep the animals in." "Oh man, you've got to be kidding," Jim muttered. "No, really," the boy replied, sounding serious indeed, and his tone, and his earnest, dirt-smeared face, and the chicken and geese flapping their wings behind him, and the sad, sick stupidity of the situation, made Jim feel like laughing out loud. But there was no time, and no real cause for laughter. The fire was licking outwards toward them, licking slowly through the growing plants, coming nearer still. "Right, okay," Jim said, offering his hand. The boy took it, held tight. "We've got to find ourselves some shelter." The boy peered through the thickening smoke. "One of the sheds?" "Our best bet," Jim agreed. "One made of stone, not wood or iron if we can help it." Instantly, the boy began to tug excitedly on his arm, and Jim let himself be led. The boy knew this complex better than he did anyway. "Rashid's bolt," the boy said, and he was running now. "It's all stone, even the ceiling. Heavy, thick." They dodged their way through the darkness, around the plants and sheds, and Jim just followed, content to let the boy guide him. "Not here, not here, the next one," the boy said. And yes, sure enough, there was a solid white concrete bunker looming in front of them. Maybe 8 feet high, 8 foot square. The boy led him around to the steel door, which was ajar. Jim peered at the structure suspiciously, and then at the boy, who nodded quickly, like he was reading Jim's mind. "Rashid sells..." and then the boy raised his thumb and forefinger to his mouth and mimed puffing, a curiously adult gesture that both shocked and saddened him. My mother says he doesn't, but he does. Also, hashish, I think. Maybe other stuff too. I don't know. Nobody will tell me. Carefully, Jim touched the door, which wasn't hot, and then pulled it fully open. The vault was lined with shelves on one side, all empty now. Somebody had been prepared for the fire, or somebody had acted damn quick. Okay, great. This'll do, Jim said, and ducked in through the small door. Come on, we'll just hole up in here until... But the boy was still standing outside, peering off through the hot night air, and then, to Jim's dismay, he began to wander off. Hey, let's get the goats, and some chickens. We could keep them in here with us, and... Quickly, Jim sprang and grabbed the boy's arm, yanking him around. No, forget it. But... And now the boy was squirming, protesting. They're not far. We just passed them. We could go back and get them and... No, Jim said, and picked the boy up again. It was harder to do without the boy's cooperation. The boy yelled and struggled to be set free. But they're right there, and we've got room. Just a couple of the goats. The closest goats. We could just... Jim carried the boy inside, and then used his weight to shove the vault door shut. Hey, he said, setting the boy down near the far wall. Hey, it's just too dangerous. We can't worry about them. We need to worry about ourselves, all right? The boy's adult facade had cracked, and he was suddenly bawling. Suddenly a small boy again, face crumpled, tears streaming down his cheeks. But what will Sulla do without her goats? We could have got them. We could have got them. Christ almighty. The kid had nearly died himself. They both could still die if the fire engulfed this place, or if the smoke did. And now he was crying about goats? Jim took a deep breath and got down on his knees in front of the boy. They're gonna be okay. Believe me, animals are pretty smart, you know. If there's another safe place here, they're gonna find it. Not as good as our place. We got the best place, the boy wailed. But we're big. They're small. They'll find some place. They'll protect each other. He didn't know what the fuck he was saying. He had no idea how goats reacted to fire. For all he knew, they were already goat shish kebabs. But he felt like he'd say anything, anything, to get the kid to stop crying. The goats all want a free cruise to the Bahamas, kid. They're playing shuffleboard on the Lido deck as we speak. The boy didn't seem to be buying it. He just sank down onto the floor and cried harder. Jim felt entirely out of his depth, and then had a flash of adult insight. The boy wasn't crying over the goats, or not entirely about the goats, but about everything. Maybe only now, when they were relatively safe and calm, was the boy processing everything that had happened to him. The fire, the terror of being trapped, the strange man bursting in, the jump out of the window. Jim settled himself against the stone wall and pulled the boy into his arms. Shh, he murmured, and stroked the boy's thick, dark hair. It's okay. You're okay. It's all gonna be okay now. To his surprise, the boy curled against him and began to weep hard against his shirt. He tightened his arms and rested his cheek against the boy's head, continuing to murmur comforting nonsense. Shh, we're fine, as the boy's arms wound around him. After a while, the boy seemed to cry himself out, falling first into random snufflings and then into silence. Jim rocked him rhythmically back and forth, conscious of the boy's hands fisting his shirt, conscious that they were breathing together, in sync, conscious of everything. The rising wail of the fire was three-dimensional in his ears, possessing colour and light.
God, he could see sound. And the heat, he could taste the heat, every degree of it. Voices in the distance, people yelling. A crowd had gathered, a much bigger crowd than before, and they were gathered around the fire, working together, trying to put it out, calling to each other in Persian. All together now, heave, and stand back, it's coming down. A woman was sobbing over her livestock, screaming she'd lost everything, everything, and would end up in the workhouse. Except he couldn't be hearing any of that. He had to be imagining it. The voices of the damned, his mind filling in the details like a memory, like a novel. Maybe, somehow, he'd lulled himself into some sort of trance. But he'd never felt more alert, more alive, never felt his senses to be more razor-sharp and acute, and his fingers were tingling, and he flexed them, feeling afraid, wondrous, awed. And then suddenly he became conscious of the fact that he was hard. His dick was rock-hard in his pants and lodged firmly against the boy's leg. Jim went cold, and his heart began to pound. "Hey," the boy muttered sleepily against his shoulder. "What's your name, anyway?" Maybe it was just some sort of residual effect of being in Rashid's shed. Rashid dealt drugs. Maybe there were traces of opium smoke in the air. How else could he be seeing colours, tasting heat, hearing voices, wanting? His throat was aching from the dry, hot air. "Christoph," he managed, which was a ludicrous answer. He'd lost his accent somewhere during the rush up the wooden staircase, when little Jimmy Allison, captain of the Cascade Wildcats, had suddenly exploded out of him, running pell-mell for the goalposts. The boy didn't seem to notice. "Hi, Christoph. Where you from?" "Deutschland," Jim repeated mechanically. He could feel the boy's leg against him, touching him, the contact dizzying, terrifying. God, what was this? "The DDR, Deutsche Demokratische Republik." "That's cool," the boy murmured and shifted against him. God, God. "Where exactly?" Jim closed his eyes and whispered, "Cascade, Washington." "That's cool," the boy said and fell silent again. Jim cleared his throat. His mouth was dry. His lips were dry. It was hot. So hot in here. "What about you? Where do you come from?" "Nowhere," the boy replied. And then he amended his answer in a phrase as patently rehearsed as Jim's own answer. "I'm a citizen of the world." And then, to Jim's surprise, the boy lifted his head and showed him a lopsided grin. He could feel the answering grin spreading across his own face. God, good old American irony. How he'd missed it. And how old was this kid? 10? 11? Old enough to figure out that he was being sold a bill of goods, that was for sure. He touched the boy's smooth cheek. "What about before you were a citizen of the world?" The boy shrugged and rested his head on Jim's shoulder as he mulled over his answer. "Not really sure. Lots of places. We were in Karachi for a while. Then we came north to here. India before that. New Delhi. But a lot of other places too. I saw the Taj Mahal. It was big, just like you'd think." He became aware that he was stroking the boy's back now. Became aware that he was trying to soak the boy up through his fingertips. He felt electricity racing through his body. He was twitching like a live wire, and he tried to still his hands, stop his hands, but found he couldn't. Impulsively, he tucked the boy's head under his chin and rested his cheek on the boy's thick, short curls, because at least this way he wouldn't be able to. He'd put the boy's red, round mouth out of sight and out of reach.
I remember green trees and a big ocean, the boy mused. I think that was Greece, but my mother says it was California. I was born in California, the boy explained. But I think she's wrong. I think the trees I remember were Greek trees. Have you ever been to Greece?
No, Jim answered hoarsely. I've never been there.
The boy shifted against him, causing him an agony of sudden ecstasy, and lifted his head. What about California? Have you been to California?
No, I mean, yes.
He felt dizzy, blinded, ripped to shreds. His hands moved to touch the boy's hair, then dropped to brush his neck before he could snatch them back and ball them into mute fists.
Yes, I've been to California.
The boy's child-soft lips taunted him, haunted him as they moved, as they spoke. This was hell. This was damnation, a purgatory of wanting.
So, the boy demanded, what about the trees? What did the trees look like?
I don't know. I don't remember. One kiss wouldn't hurt, couldn't hurt, would damn him forever.
Cause see, I'm pretty sure they were olive trees, except maybe they were grapes. And if they were grapes, then maybe it was California. Except I'm pretty sure they were olives. Unless they have olive trees in California too. And then, hey mister, are you alright?
I'm damned. I'm damned. I'm going mad.
Because you don't look so good.
The boy's voice was full of concern. The boy looked like Jim's pain was breaking his heart. Jim forced himself to go still, to go limp, to freeze solid in this fiery hell, locking everything down and in.
Hey, it's okay.
The boy crooned in a grotesque parody, an awful echo of his own words. Everything's going to be okay. And the boy was touching Jim's cold, frozen face with his hot, slightly sticky hands. Jim's body was thrumming, his cock was thrumming, and he stared into the blue eyes of future damnation.
Really, the boy assured him earnestly, everything's going to be fine.
The kiss was cherry hot, superbly sweet, and Jim heard the audible crack of something snapping deep within him, something hard and brittle and structurally necessary breaking for good, leaving him forever damaged. And the momentum of the fracture jerked him forward, moved his hands to cup the boy's soft, sweet face, and he just kissed his skin and kissed his eyes and kissed his lips and kissed him till the fire all burned out.
That's the end of part one of The Fire by Francesca.